Welcome to NeuroNoodles Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jake Gunkelman. He's the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans, and Dr. Marie Swingle, author of iMinds. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as the featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
Hello, Pete.
The president of the Elon Musk fan club.
Well, he has so many bags under his eyes. He could have a Sherpa in there, you know, hauling luggage. So,
I thought we were a mental health podcast, so we would be more open to his quirky ways.
Well, you can have quirky ways, but as you start to see it have what's obviously degradation of his physical and probably mental function as well. Sleep is crucial. Yeah. And your eyes get those deep bags from having funky sleep patterns. So
FDR.
Anyway, I'm happy to see his little mobile home, you know, or ADU home designs or whatever you want to call those, but it'd be, you know, he's turning out some interesting things, and he deserves to have a fairly long shot at being somebody who generates things. So I'd hate to see him take such poor care of himself that he's not still functioning in another decade or two. So,
well, he was a proponent of Ozempic. Said it worked for him.
You know, there's lots of ways to get in shape, and some people may need some assistance with something like Ozempic or bariatric surgery or things like that. I mean, neurofeedback and you've seen Dirk Ritter's work on craving in eating disorders being treatable. So there's old fashioned exercise and getting up and about and things like that, but you sent out all sorts of nice links for mental health sort of things.
It's all the same stuff. This is what people are talking about, you know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be relevant, but this is all people are talking about.
Yeah.
So what's everybody talking about? Good morning.
You saw the list of deteriorating neuropsychiatric presentations in kids and stuff, and you know, quite honestly, I wasn't aware of the severity and how rapidly it's degrading, in a decade, serious suicidal considerations in young girls went from 20% to 30%, and kids with really serious concerns went from like 37 to 57%. So, you know, the more than average, that you got better than 50-50 chance of seeing a kid that age, or a girl that age, at least with some serious concerns. So, you know, and
why is that happening?
Well, you know, we have some idea. So this is the theta beta ratio in 1999, and the ADD versus normal could be differentiated 95 to 98% accuracy. It got the FDA approval as a diagnostic metric back then. But as you see, the theta-beta ratio across time, the effect size, which is the ability to separate two groups, and here the effect size is really quite good, and the effect size has dropped down to the groups are overlapping so badly, you could get the same odds as flipping a coin diagnostically differentiating here. So it's no longer, the theta beta ratio is no longer any good at identifying ADD. And what's happened? Kids have 2 hours less sleep per night on the average. And, you know, if you don't have sufficient sleep, you carry over sleep debt, and your theta frequencies go up and your beta frequencies go down, and the theta beta ratios degrades. This is what it looked like in the original study. Here's the ADD group, the mean and the standard deviation. Here's the control group, the mean and standard deviation. The standard deviations didn't even touch. I mean, these are two separate curves. That's why you get such a high diagnostic specificity back then. But as you can see, the mean and the standard deviation in the current studies, they overlap so badly, you really can't differentiate one from the other here. So the 2 hours less sleep per night seems to be important. Now, another paper that you put out suggested that there were comorbid deteriorations with people that had sleep problems and circadian problems. And this paper is looking at children that are diagnosed with ADD. And it basically says there's one group that's basically got a primary disorder of vigilance. They just cannot stay awake. And because they can't stay awake, they look very inattentive. And this is like narcolepsy with no cataplexy. And quite often, these kids respond better to modafinil, which is a treatment for narcolepsy, than they do to any of the other stimulants. There's another one here that's a delayed circadian rhythm. And this one is problematic. Your little article said that there's a correlation between bipolar disorder and people that have a circadian rhythm problem. And this sleep problem is diagnosable. It's a delayed circadian rhythm. And if you wear an actigraph, which is like a Fitbit for a sleep lab, and the actigraph, 1 week of data will start to show if there's a delayed circadian pattern. And if you've got that, you're at high risk of later life developing bipolar disorder. But in the interim, you're going to look very inattentive because you can't fall asleep easily, and you got to get up at a certain point in time. So you're going to be, you know, delayed onset, but you've got to get up on an alarm to get to school. So you're going to carry sleep debt. And at this point, it's very hard to see a 10-minute eyes closed EEG from a kid who doesn't actually either fall asleep or have sufficient drowsiness to the point where, you know, the they're dozing off and bumping into stage two sleep within a 10-minute study. And that if they do it before 5 minutes, they actually would qualify as a sleep study candidate because of a precipitous descent into stage two sleep. But if you've got that circadian delay, you can treat that circadian delay. In fact, this is the map of the United States, solar radiation, the area of the U.S. that gets all the solar intensity here. You'd think Florida, but they got a lot of cloud cover there too. But the desert Southwest is really intense. And you can see this is the CDC map with the incidence of ADD, ADHD. And there's about a 10% drop between the low solar intensity areas and the high solar intensity areas. And these are likely people that have this essentially a bipolar disorder that's being treated with bright light in the morning. And you can treat somebody with a circadian delay with bright light in the morning and melatonin in the evening to reset the circadian delay. And, we can see the stats from CDC overlay with the solar radiation. And again, this is how bright and intense the sunlight is. And essentially, you're treating the circadian delay people and also seasonal affective disorder people with the bright lights. And the other groups here, these are people that have restless leg syndrome. And you also can have people have breathing problems at night. But if you have a sleep problem, you're quite likely to end up looking inattentive at school. And lifestyle has degraded to the point where they're getting 2 hours less sleep per night, and that's not sustainable.
Yeah, if I could jump in here, well, one further comment on the data, and then I can jump to culture. But one of the things that we're noticing systematically and have been, I would say it's a 10-year cascade. You mentioned the theta beta ratio over the central areas, but we're noticing just rocket down speed on the theta beta ratio in the occiput. You know, when we used to say a ratio of 0.8 was dysfunctional, we're now regularly seeing people 0.5. All our data used to say that quiescence individuals that did not report any issues with stress, anxiety, insomnia, et cetera, our cutoff used to be 1.8. You know, we're not seeing that anymore. I mean, it's depending on how you play with stats, that's 100% reduction in the ratio. You know, whether that's the theta that's insufficient or just this ambient beta, you know, beta brains, so many beta brains, but, you know, it is in the whole population. Why, you know, chicken or egg? But culturally, one of the things I comment over and over again is I really am having major, major issues with the expectations we place on young families. Okay. The whole notion of the super mom, you know, that you're neglecting or your child is underprivileged if they're not in 21,000 activities, you know, this rush, 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 go, go, go. Most children's in affluent families are out and about doing activities until 8 p.m., rushing to eat. And then, oh my gosh, we have to do our homework. It's not sustainable. So you're actually coaching anxiety and stress into children. The other is, I mean, most of us, even when we have the best day and we come home, yeah, okay, none of us are ready to sleep. You know, we need to decompress. We need our downtime. And guess what our downtime is? Our downtime is screen time. So, I mean, I how long do we have, Pete and Jay? I can literally talk 3 days on this, but you know, if you're concerned about your children's mental health or the mental health of children, take it down 10 levels and get off your bloody interactive tech. You know, the reason why young females are so depressed, or the primary reason, I have to be careful about absolutes, is the comparatives online. You know, all of the social media in terms of who is showing what, you know, it's all about the latest lips and lipstick and magnetic. You know, like, come on, who are we comparing ourselves to? They're unsustainable goals. All of the filters that are used. Okay. If you also you look at the communication of younger people, it's not positive. A lot of it is very, very critical. If you just kind of transcribe and look at the scripts. So, I mean, we have a major cultural issue here. We need more community, more downtime, more family time. However the heck you define family, I don't care.
We've missed that.
By technology. Technology's revenge. Yeah. My last little comment there is this has been going on for generations. It's not new. But we have also a culture of what I call sleep competition. Okay. In terms of who gets the social reward, okay? The person who says, I had a lovely dinner with my family and read a bit and went to bed at 10:30. No, it's the person who worked their patootie off and says, I was up working on the project till 12, or I was racing here. They're the individuals that get the social reward. So until we give...
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Social reward for taking care of yourself. Until we give social reward for doing positive things for yourself, as opposed to calling people lazy, you know, until we give social reward for the kids who are just rolling around on the floor screaming and yelling and fighting with their siblings. Yeah, it's a mass issue, and I think everything is just combining now in the perfect storm.
The color of the lights that we used to have with the incandescent bulbs that were kind of yellowy. There's a different impact of the bright blue of the LED lights, and that has an effect on the nervous system that's more activating. You can actually get software for your computer that slightly shifts the color balance.
Dave, I could
more...
interrupt before we get onto the computer, though. I'm just immediately piggybacking what you were saying. Grandma's light shades, lampshades, okay? Where was the light in older homes and how was it covered? Okay, so you had the bulb in the ceiling with a globe over it, okay? You had a table lamp with a lampshade, okay? The light was never direct in your eyes. And I think this started, correct me if I'm wrong, there were some of the beautiful Italian designs in the late 1980s where the shades were gone and bulbs were direct. It was gorgeous lighting. I mean, none of us could afford it at the time. It was beautiful lighting, but it switched over time to where the bulbs are directly exposed. And then leading right into what Jay was saying, the bulbs themselves now are different. Like LEDs are great for the planet, horrible for humans. So going back to you, Jay, in terms of the screens.
So the color on the screen on your computer can be more red in the evening and more blue in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's a subtle shift. It isn't like you're dramatically shifting, but the impact of that is useful. There are people that are starting to turn off the lights and use alternative lighting, candlelight and things, winding it down and cutting down on the number of lights to let yourself wind down. There's lots of things that you can do to kind of help trick your body into thinking the sun has set. It's time to wind it down for sleep. And melatonin is triggered by that change in light. Assuming you're looking at the natural cycle of melatonin, sunset triggers your melatonin.
Cultures too, Jay. You know, you don't have to go back too far, and in certain regions of the world as well, even in the middle of summer, people close their shutters at a certain hour in the night. And most of North America, people don't even know what shutters are, right? Yeah. But most windows.
You go far enough north, and you pretty much have to. You've got the 24-hour workday. If you're just looking at how bright it is, 10, 11 at night, you still have the sun up.
But I mean, even in southern France, of Italy, whatnot, people close their shutters. Even depending on the construction of the homes, they got more modernized. But this was a cultural thing. Families shut down and shut in past a certain hour of night, and again the lights in the house went on. So there's a lot of, I don't even want to say old world knowledge, it's only around 30-40 years ago that we really started to change these things in line with the upcoming technology. I think we have to go back to some of our older wisdom. The other thing, and my clients laugh at me all the time, and we have a good chuckle, but I don't know that I've said this on the show before. I call them granny glaucoma glasses. No insult to all of our grannies, whether they're with us or have passed over. But I really recommend that people go to their local hospital where they perform eye surgeries, where it is absolutely critical that you do not have any form of blue light coming into the eyes post-surgery. Okay. And they tend to be surgeries performed on the eyes of elderly people. They have these absolutely horribly ugly wraparound glasses in red or orange or brown that prevent the majority of blue light coming through.
Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
Now, yes, you can go online, buy this, buy that, but they're not tested. So if you know of a really good company, everybody's selling these type of things, but you want the medical grade. And if you put those on late at night when you're interacting with your computer, I mean, I don't have the exact data. Jay's our data man, but there's potential. I would say you cut it out by at least 50%. So get anti-fashion, put these glasses on.
I don't have any degrees on the wall, but I've heard and seen where, for whatever reason, we started this talk about teens committing suicide, taking their own lives, not coping. And I've heard that whatever the anxieties are, the reason for not sleeping besides light or whatever, you can only go a certain amount of nights without sleep, right? And as each day goes by, I don't know what the stat is, but one night without sleep is like getting a DUI, and then your brain doesn't function. And at the end of it, you can't take anymore. And then you say enough is enough. What's going on with the brain for somebody that's happening to?
So in EEG, sleep deprivation is a technique that's used. in a known epileptic, somebody that has a history of epilepsy, if you look at their EEG for 20 minutes, which is a minimum standard for a length of a total EEG, you have a little over 50% chance of seeing a diagnostic discharge because they're intermittent. So you might catch one in 20 minutes. And everybody thinks, well, you go to the hospital, they use the photic stimulation, and that's how they get their increased diagnostic yield. But that's not true. You get a 4% additional yield from photic stimulation above the base EEG. But sleep deprivation brings out the transients, and you get a 50 to 70% increase in the yield. So if you've got a little instability that's not really very florid when you've been well rested and you miss a night, it's going to be a flashing red light. If you miss two nights, it may become clinically out of your control. You know, people that have discharges in the temporal lobe can end up having events that they're not even aware of. Rage events, pseudobulbar affect, emotions that don't make sense, a fit of laughter that's not even funny, but they're totally out of control emotional expressions that are just discharges out of the temporal lobe. So if you want to end up having a psychiatric diagnosis of some sort by looking extremely not normal, go without sleep for a few nights. Your behavior is going to be diagnosable in some way. But then that's the DSM diagnostics. I'm not that worried about what they diagnose. But, you know, if you return to proper sleep, it ends up helping. Excess sleep is also a problem. You know, Martine Arns has a nice study showing in depression, individuals tend to sleep a little longer, a little excess. And instead of 9+ hours a night, if they decrease the total number of hours of sleep back to a normal amount of sleep, that helps with their mood. So sleep deprivation or excess sleep, either one of them are not normal, healthy patterns. So if you want to end up having a healthy brain, you've got to have healthy sleep.
On clocks, you know, whether we're talking about sleep, whether we're talking about eating, all of these things. And I think one of our major errors we make is we always forget we're biological beings, right? And biological beings with rhythm. Jay, my cutoff is 3 days, that after 3 days, like, poof, somebody is just gone in every sense of the word. But I think we've also talked about this before as well. What is one of the most common or through history torture techniques? Sleep deprivation. Okay. To get people to talk and just to make them as miserable as possible, to induce psychoses, to induce, right? It's harmful for us to deprive ourselves from sleep, you know, and systematically. And then, of course, looping back to the young females, or for that matter, anyone, you're sleep deprived, and then you get all these lovely messages from social media about how you're not good enough. And then you get all these messages from your friends that are gossiping about this, that, and the other. And then you have to, pay attention at soccer, or you're going to be accused of having ADHD. Like, it just goes on and on and on. Sleep well, eat well, have fun, people.
Is sleep the easiest thing you can correct?
Depends.
Sleep onset insomnia and wakefulness have been proven to be able to be treated effectively. Now, not everybody has the form of insomnia where you have beta spindles at CZ and you can train SMR to stabilize the brain. When you get to stage two sleep, the vertex sharp wave that happens is your response to a sound. if you have a good sleep spindle, which is SMR during the day, sleep spindle at night, same generator. If you have a good SMR, you continue to drift off. But if you don't, if you have a beta spindle there instead, you wake up for all of those. So you have sleep onset problems and wakefulness. Training of SMR in Europe, in Salzburg, Austria, the Consciousness and Sleep Lab, Wolfgang Klemisch's lab, they actually did the studies with college students that had some insomnia, which is not necessarily the worst insomniacs, but they did 10 training sessions of SMR and found significant improvement in sleep and improvement in memory function as well. You sleep, you've got memory consolidation during sleep. So that was replicated in Graz, Austria, exactly. Yes, college students with insomnia effectively treated 10 sessions. But Salzburg recruited clinically really bad insomniacs, like the world-class insomniacs, you know, I haven't slept in years, I've tried everything, you know, those, not a student that's got a little bit of a sleep issue, but a world-class insomniac, Guinness World of Record, you know, sort of level. So they recruited them. And they basically did 10 sessions like the college students, and they found it ineffective. Now, we had already worked with elite athletes in Australia, the Australian Institute for Sports, and their elite athletes have sleep problems. Well, elite athletes, some of them are for pretty finely tuned instruments, and they're a little tightly wrapped, you know, and the sleep onset is not good. And if you're not sleeping well, you're never going to be a world-class athlete. You may be damn good, but you're not going to be world-class. You have to sleep to have recovery from the wear and tear of the workout. If you don't, you get micro tears that add up and you have a muscle strain. And if you don't sleep well, you don't remember what the coach taught you. All that declarative, semantic and declarative memory that's consolidated at night, short-term memory from yesterday. But what did that say? What were they talking about yesterday? We were in that room for a couple of hours going over plays, but that was X's and arrows. I can't remember what the hell they were talking about. You know, you can't be world class unless you sleep well. So they recognized that, and we did 24 training sessions of SMR in world class athletes that had really bad insomnia. And they have a strong drive, and there's a lot of beta associated with that. So they needed the SMR training, and it helped to the point where now if they're – and they had a control group, and they showed that the SMR ended up helping with the outcomes based on self-report and sleep lab tracking and so forth. So it was actually a control study outcome. Now, if you're an athlete in Australia and you're complaining of insomnia, you get SMR training. Now, it's not always CZ beta. Occasionally, you've got a frontal midline. You lay down to go to sleep and you ruminate. You just get stuck on something. It's not a physical buzz where you can't wind down. This is your brain locked onto something. And that's the anterior cingulate. You can't fix that with SMR at the vertex. You have to fix that.
I want to loop in the athletes with the students for one. Same thing. You know, an athlete is not going to remember what was said, but also you know, a student is not going to remember the lesson. They're not going to integrate the information through sleep. So it's the same thing. But also, I think a key population is those with trauma. I mean, true trauma. Trauma is absolutely overused as a term now. I think we've talked about hurt versus harm, like people who have really experienced harm. There's a reason why they can't sleep. Because every time again, Dr. Marian are absolutes. I have to stop it. When the body goes into quiet, preparing it for sleep, and there's a noise, that's your danger wake up signal. Okay. So, and I'm going to be genderist. A lot of females have experienced sexual assault, usually in the evening, very frequently in their own beds. Same thing with children who have had sexual assault, molestation when they're younger. So these individuals, this is not an SMR issue. This is a trauma. So this is where we also look at the alpha. Okay. And depending on what is found or what is not found, training the individual to accept quiet as a safe state. So you really, really have to look at your EEG and also know a little bit about your client's history. So a lot of the females, again, with this chronic insomnia, you're actually talking about trauma, and the symptom is insomnia.
In trauma, you end up with the amygdala with an emotional charge. Anxiety, fear, even anger can do this, but it changes the thalamic gating. And the P100, the arrival of the sensory input to the cortex, is early and large. We see that with lambda at the back of the head. But if you close your eyes and you're going to go to sleep, the P100 for auditory is the vertex wave that is going to wake you up. So you're still that emotion that you're carrying has your arrival of this vertex wave is going to be big and alarming, as opposed to being moderated by the normal thalamic gating. This is very well documented as a mechanism, and you can kind of identify this with the event-related potential testing. Yuri Kropotov has independent component analysis of the ERP, and the first component of a visual ERP is the arrival of the P100 at the back of the head. Well, they've got a normative database, and it tells them how big it should be and how latent it should be. And if it's early and big, you've got yourself with somebody who's got an affective issue going on. And you can go to other forms of stimuli, a novelty stimulus, and they can't suppress the response to novelty. They'll give you another large P100. So there's ERP diagnostics that go along with what you see of that, the quiet state and the alarm that you pop back up too easily. That's essentially, again, carrying a residual charge in the amygdala and changing your thalamic gating, so you're super sensitive to input.
Part of the processing that's going on when you're sleeping, do dreams come into play in that? And then what are dreams? I've heard they're a fear and a wish combined. Thoughts?
You know, people have lots of mixed up ideas about what dreams can be. There's hypnagogic imagery as you're falling asleep. That's not a REM state dream. Rapid eye movement, REM state, happens during sleep. And then if you wake up and you have kind of a dreamlike period, that's the hypnopompic state. And the hypnagogic and hypnopompic are usually more understandable and usually fully colored. And but REM sleep dreams, sometimes you wake up and can't actually retrieve them. Because there's a separation between REM and awake consciousness to a certain extent. But REM is a normal part of sleep, and if you don't have REM, you don't end up having memory consolidation. You can take things for sleep that are REM suppressors. Benzodiazepines and hypnotics are REM suppressors. They may help you be unconscious at night. What I call Michael Jackson sleep, you know, I mean, he was unconscious at night, propofol. He had a doctor there dripping that stuff in, you know, keeping him unconscious. But your brain is busy doing stuff it's supposed to do at night. You're not aware, but that's a busy, busy brain. Metabolically, you can see it in a SPECT scan of a brain during sleep. It's busy. You can see the same brain with Ambien or Lunesta or any of the hypnotic sleep meds or benzodiazepines, and you see his blue brain of no metabolic function. Again, you can be unconscious at night. That's not sleep. And a lot of the sleep aids that are out there ruin your sleep. They don't help. You might feel like you slept. You're unconscious for 8 hours or something, but your brain should cycle 90-minute cycles. In the first half of the night, you get more slow wave sleep. You're growing dendritic connections that you're going to end up playing memories through in REM. And the things you did during the day, bits and pieces of your past, all of that stuff is thrown together in your REM. But you consolidate memory by playing back things in these new connections you just made. Long-term potentiation happens in sleep, a complex relationship between slow wave and REM. And, we used to ask people in the sleep lab if there was a new tech about a few weeks into them actually being in the lab, are you having EEG dreams yet? And they'd be shocked. Oh my God, you know that what we're dreaming, you know. But if you're encoding something into your long-term memory, something that you learned during the day, like the image, the waveform, that funny little wiggle that you just learned, if that's being encoded, that's going to be part of the dream state encoding into a new connection. So you could predict whether the tech was likely to be a good tech or not if they're actually paying attention enough to have something being encoded, you know?
Doctor, secret sleep questions. Yeah. No, I just want to absolutely punch, please, Pete, what Jay said, underline that for individuals that are taking sleep aids, you're making the situation worse. The other is a lot of the treatment that we do is much less efficient because we're not dealing with a clean brain. So all of you folks practicing, if you have individuals on certain classes of meds, they sleep really well on their meds and your treatment isn't working. So, I mean, you have to be very, very transparent about what your client is taking and the benefits and not benefits and risks, but, you know, if they really want to give their neuro therapy a good chance, sometimes it's not complementary, it's competitive with some of the meds. I have to qualify, I'm not a psychiatrist, not an MD, check all of this with the proper people, but let it be out there. The other thing that Jay said is in terms of consolidation. Okay, we have all of these experiences floating around. If they never kind of unite, the pieces of the puzzle of your life are always going to be scrambled. So in terms of, you know, whether this is your education, whether this is your emotional learning, sleep is absolutely critical to consolidate, to assimilate, to move forward, I would say, in both your emotional and cognitive experience. And again, looping right back in, you know, to happiness and to understanding things, what the brain does during sleep. Wowzers.
Yeah, but yeah. Dr. Marie, why do I keep having the dream where I have the final exam I didn't prepare for and I'm in my underwear?
You have not consolidated it yet. You know, it's kind of funny. You know, we all have our little ways of working with people. I know some individuals in pediatrics do not agree with me. So, you know, we have to respect difference, but I never worry, you know, if individuals have a nightmare for around 6 months. It means you're still processing something. You're still trying to consolidate. Okay. After the 6 month mark, then we start to look at things. Okay. Even little kids, like parents out there, your kid is working on something. Let the brain work it through. Do whatever you can to, you know, help them have a good sleep and work things through. Jay, did you want to pipe in there?
I was going to say, Pete, didn't your mom tell you to wear clean skivvies? You know, I mean,
that was the problem. Yeah.
But why did I have to have rubber sheet? What's going on there?
You got a lot to consolidate, but then, you know, that luckily, you know, some people, you know,
but it is kind of funny though. So, you know, sometimes we all do have that one dream that kind of comes back, you know, something's going on that's making you rethink and consolidate something. I don't know. I find it fascinating.
Well, in all seriousness, I bring up the rubber sheets, but kids go to the bathroom at night during the sleep. What's going on there?
It depends upon what age it's happening at, actually. And it's normal for young kids to end up having nocturnal enuresis. However, after a certain point, it becomes unusual. Now, it can run in families where they don't stop until they're 9, 10 years old. And that's going to be very difficult, because going over to somebody's house and wetting the bed at somebody else's house isn't the same. Going to camp and peeing in your sleeping bag and having to be the one in your cabin to hang your sleeping bag out every day. There are things that are going to be problematic about it, but it's also possibly a sign of nocturnal epilepsy. And that if it's persisting beyond a very young age, you need to start to think there may be an electrical storm that creates urination, defecation. And that you have to take that into account. Again, very young kids, this is normal biological stuff.
Yeah,
but as you get older, you have to start to look for medical reasons.
Yeah, I want to piggyback everything that Jay is saying. You know, my cutoff for male children is around 9. You know, that's when we start to look at it. But, you know, from, you know, 5 to 9, this just happens occasionally more for male children than female children. I'm not sure why, but we just kind of know this. The other is, you know, just in terms of helping to quiet parents to understand, you know, how many advertisements are there on TV for pull-ups and overnights and whatnot. That tells you how common it is, because they would not be doing this mass marketing if it wasn't common. So don't worry too much, unless it's very frequent. So the occasional little thing. Also, if you look back into, you know, boarding schools, Pete, you're joking about your rubber sheets. Like, standard pro forma for kids in boarding school, everybody had to have a rubber sheet. There's a reason for this. And anybody who works systematically with children or markets to children knows this. But Jay, just to help the clinicians out there, what is your cutoff for frequency of urination, say after, I would say 8 to 9, in terms of when you should get checked? Because we all know the longer if somebody really is having nocturnal seizures, you want to get on it. So what is your cutoff?
In fact, if you're seeing them in the office for neurofeedback anyway, you have a high probability of already having recorded an EEG. And if you see paroxysms that you're not familiar with, you should have somebody take a peek at that. But you may be able to catch it in your routine assessment. Now, you're not doing the recording at night, but if you're seeing paroxysmal discharges during the day, it's not uncommon for them to be more florid during sleep. In fact, there's some kinds of seizures that happen in their sleep. There's electrographic status epilepticus of sleep, ESES, and that that's a particular kind. You go to sleep and you basically start having a continuous seizure. It's hard to have a good night's sleep with that, you know. So it's particularly disabling for a family to have a child. I mean, you've got a night shift to take care of a child who's seizing all night. And so there's that. Others, like the benign Rolandic epilepsy, which is called Rolandic epilepsy in Europe, they drop the benign. It's not benign. They typically don't have seizures, as they're very uncommon. So they're very frequently not treated. John Hughes's work showed that if you treat them, they actually have a better life outcome, higher level of education, better income, better life satisfaction scales, but no difference in seizures because they're very rare in the first place. But when they do happen, they're usually in their sleep and quite often not observed. So there are folks that have seizures, and they happen in transitional stages. If your brain is not fully awake or not fully asleep, you're in a transitional stage, and during transitional stages, transients come out. And that's why the sleep deprivation ends up bringing out transients with the studies. But, you know, you can imagine during the day you're awake, at night when you're asleep, but on the way to sleep, you can end up being in this unstable state. You've gone to bed and end up having a seizure at night.
So if you can't sleep, we'll close out with this, guys. More often than not, what do you think you're going to be training to help? Somebody says, hey, I just can't sleep. What does a clinician do?
Got to look at the EEG, Pete. Neither Jay or I are going to give you one answer. Sorry. It depends.
Yeah. You're asking the hammer if the world looks like a nail, you know? So, yeah. If they can't sleep, we need to look at their brain activity to see what the issue is. If they've got an anterior cingulate issue, they may be ruminating. If they have beta spindles at CZ, they may have a wakefulness drive that's unrelenting. We can treat both of those, but we treat them differently. And there may be something uniquely different about somebody. Their brain may be generally inflamed or something. We would have to look at the person to individualize the approach. And personalized and evidence-based both are good things. We've got the ability to personalize the approach to the person's brain individually, but we also have evidence-based approaches.
Yeah. I guess the big thing is look for the quieting, you know, where's the extra buzz. Then go after quieting wherever in the brain that is. Yeah. Look for where the brain isn't quiet. Sorry. I misspoke there.
Your local sleep lab, wherever you're at, is going to end up having a list of things that they call sleep hygiene. Mm-hmm. Sleep hygiene is not taking a shower before you go to bed. That's not a bad idea sometimes, but what we're talking about are, what's the time you last ate? Are you working out just before you go to bed, or are you winding down before you go to bed? How about that flashing light in the window? Do you have a blackout shade to get rid of that flashing light in the window? What's the illumination? Is your alarm clock a big white light flashing in your face? What's the sound level?
And do you need some partners? That's a big one that couples have to deal with as well. So that's an environmental one, unfortunately, for many people.
And then I can close out with the last one. And if you're a bedwetter in your 50s or 60s, what's the cure? It depends.
Oh, Pete.
Jay Gunkelman, Dr. Marie Swingle. Glad to have you back, Dr. Marie.
My pleasure.
Another great episode of the Neuro Noodle Neurofeedback Podcast. Where's our other co-host?
He was up here with a toy and about to intrude into the image. I kind of kept him at bay, and he took off.
Renita's got a treat.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt.
All right, everybody, have a great
Good to
week.
See you all.
Get
you
some good
too.
sleep.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
The NeuroNoodle podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.